Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I am your host, Rituparna Padkiri, on New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Today, I am going to be in conversation with Jagriti Gangopadhyay, the author of the book, Culture, Context and Aging of Older Indians, Narratives from India and Beyond, published in 2021 by Springer Nature. Dr. Jagriti Gangopadhyay has a PhD from the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT Gandhinagar. Currently, she is an assistant professor at the Manipal Center for Humanities, Manipal. Jagriti, welcome to the podcast. I'm glad that you could make it.
Thank you so much, Rituparna. And I'd also like to thank New Books Network, as well as my host, Dr. Rituparna Padgiri, for this huge opportunity.
Right. So let me begin with a very common question. What was your inspiration behind the book? What inspired you to write this book?
I think that is a very important question, and it's, I think, a good time for me to really look back. Well, I started writing this book during the first phase of the lockdown because I had time, and also I had someone to look after my child, my husband, and we were there with my extended family, so there were a lot of people to look after the child, and and my family members really motivated me to write the book, to convert my PhD thesis into a book. My father primarily, who went on telling me that, it is very important that I convert this. I had individual papers, but he also thought that I should narrate about my field experiences. And that is very important because, he felt that that is something that would also help me contribute to the discipline. And my husband also really motivated me, and he constantly pushed me that I should, it is also important to write, you base your thesis, your book on, first book on your thesis. That way, continuity will also be there. So both of these reasons basically were the main guiding factors, to convert my book into a thesis, my thesis into a book, sorry.
Right. So you've talked about your personal inspiration. Could you also say something about your academic, inspiration, motive behind writing the book?
Yes, you're right. Actually, I should have added that when you asked initially. When I was, I thought of converting the book, when I started writing the book, there were two factors. One, I felt in our discipline, broadly, sociology, social gerontology, there was a dearth of literature on comparative studies between different countries. And in general, you know, comparative studies also as a concept, I felt needed more expansion. So I really wanted to expand that narrative. And my book is a comparison of aging practices across the globe in different parts of the globe, primarily, of course, India and Canada, but I've also touched upon policy. And in addition to that, this comparative perspective, I also felt the urban story of aging across the globe needs to be told, because there is a lot of literature on the rural, you know, aspect of aging, growing old, and the challenges and the problems. Urban, not just India, but urban older people generally have been neglected in media, scholarship. So I also wanted to tell their story. Hence, that was one of the reasons why I wrote this book. And finally, I also felt that that I needed to write about my field experiences. And this is why methodology plays a very important part in this book, because I myself as a researcher felt that, you know, while we read a lot of important textbooks and also a lot of field-driven books with regard to methodology in India, but the problem is that, again, you know, rural, they're slightly rural-based and they're slightly more objective in nature. This subjective intersection and of the researcher and how he or she interprets the field is missing. So I also wanted to, so because of all these factors inspired me to write the book.
Right. So one of the methods that you have used extensively is multi-sited ethnography, if I'm correct. Right. So what were your field sites and some of the other research methods that you have used in your book? Also, I would also like to know what was your experience of conducting this research in very geographically diverse locations?
Yeah, well, this is a very, very long question. It might take some time. So I primarily used semi-structured questionnaires in all my field areas, and I conducted in-depth narrative style interviews, which the target was 1.5 hours, but it actually went on for hours, 2 to 3 hours, and sometimes they never ended. But I never did more than one interview a day. Because I particularly wanted to go back with the interview, think about the interview while making notes, while listening to the recordings. I really wanted to, you know, feel the interview. I just didn't want to do the interview and see my data as data. I wanted to really understand and interpret the data as well. So I also wanted to reflect on the multiple dialogues I had with the respondents. And one of the biggest experiences that I had across the field was that there were, you know, interactions. So we go with the understanding and objective that we will ask our questions and come back, but it never happens like that. I also was asked many personal questions. Initially, I was offended. Then I kind of understood gradually that if I am asking them so many personal questions, they also have the right to ask me personal questions. I need to give them this intrusive space in my life as well. And I just cannot come across as this researcher who is there to collect information and go. And that way I felt that, you know, I will not be able to do justice to my data either. And also before I began my primary data collection, I always do pilots. Like I test my questionnaire and I want to see whether it's making sense. And all of these, actually, I learned a lot from my pilot studies also, where I got very good feedback for my questionnaire and it was tested. And I also learned how to really ask, you know, difficult questions in the sense, because I was asking about later life experiences. And one thing that I needed to understand about how older people think about death. So honestly, I had a very direct question, do you think about death in that sense, you know? And much later on with my pilot, I tweaked that question about, you know, what is your biggest fear? Because when one is young and one is starting out in a PhD, one doesn't really know how to go about it. I was also naive in that sense. So these were some of my biggest learnings on the field. To answer your question about multi-sited, I think each field has had its own experiences, you know, and one can really go on. But I will just break it down. The family, I think, in terms of setting, it was, of course, more welcoming, but also careful, because I was interviewing so many different family members, one at a time, with different questionnaires. They were very curious, and I think the biggest takeaway from the family interviews was that they were, very helpful, but also initially there was slight hesitation, and rapport building took much more time because I was exploring intergenerational relationships within different family members. Institutionally, I think the older people were most forthcoming with their responses, and they were very eager to tell me about their experiences in residing in elder care institutions. And it still is a very new concept in India. So they were very keen to tell me why and how they were navigating this space. But yes, one of the biggest challenges I faced was with permissions, and that took a while. And, I was also really given very little time to do my data collection. And initially, I was told I would be monitored, and then, after much persuading, was I given complete freedom to do the interviews on my own. So the institution in itself, it could became, like a sort of a barrier. And in my diaspora, I think, I generally was very, very well welcomed, and because I myself was from India, I was interviewing older Indians who had settled. They really took very good care of me, and the interviews were definitely converted into extensive meals, and I also really was given a lot of additional information. So in the diasporic setting, I think my biggest challenge was that of filtering, because I had so much information, so huge, the data set became so huge that I really didn't know which one to leave out and which one to kind of keep. So these were some of the major experiences that I had on the field.
Thank you. Sounds very, very interesting. So now a question, related to the content of your book. I would like to know how cultural practices and contextual factors help in shaping the subjectivities as well as variations that are involved in the process and experiences of aging.
Yeah. So I'll go back a little bit, in the literature review. And when I started doing research for my thesis, I realized that we have a very one-dimensional perspective of growing old, not just in India, I would say, but across the globe. So, for instance, in India, the general idea is that older people are vulnerable, they're frail, and they're dependent. And just opposite to India, this is a similar narrative in South Asia. In different countries like Japan and China, there is a little bit different narrative of how the country population is generally aging, and the children have come up with different forms of caregiving arrangements, because filial piety continues to be the cultural domination of those countries. And in the West, like for instance, particularly North America, there it is characterized by successful aging, everybody has to age very, aging means you have to be healthy, you have to be active, you have to be productive. Unless you really fall into those goals and norms, you don't really age well. And there's also a lot of pressure to age well. So I really felt that while these were very important contributions and detailed studies, I also felt that these are, a very imposed narrative of aging, and aging definitely is much more than that. It is not just one kind of an experience, a homogeneous experience. We cannot say that two older people age the same way. It is so diverse. It is so different. While one might adopt active aging, one might just choose to, age peacefully, adopt religion. And the other problem in India is that primarily in institutional settings, older people are coerced into being religious. You have to listen, you have to really absorb religion, because that is how you will gradually come closer to death. So one is also really coerced into a particular way of aging. So how I really wanted to understand that and explore, and that was also my major argument, that our own cultural practices and belief systems play a very big role in shaping our later life experiences. And however, these cultural practices are also marked by external factors such as globalization. So, for instance, I saw, particularly because I was doing it in the urban area, so, you know, like people in Delhi and, you know, like the really urban metropolitan spaces, they would like to adopt active aging, for example, you know, and they're very pro on social media. They don't really see themselves to be old, and they really would like to remain fit and active as long as possible. But similarly, relatedly, there is another side of narrative in India, you know, as a country, that people are eager to talk about death. People want to be a part of religious activities. They want to be viewed as traditional kinkeepers. So in both the countries' context, Canada as well as India, I felt there was a huge balance of both the narratives. People wanted to age successfully, as well as people wanted to, you know, also grow old and understand the different nuanced experiences of later life. Then I also saw the other interesting thing about gender, that actually with age, people also have very different expectations from older spouses. And of course, I saw that, you know, in despite my being in a very urban setting, caregiving arrangements, older men continued to expect caregiving responsibility from their older spouses and not really from their adult children. That was a marked difference from my Western experience, where I saw that both men and women knew they had to be independent and rely on, you know, other paid caregiving services and not on their spouses or on their adult children. So that was the major difference that I saw. But apart from that, I generally felt that cultural practices, you know, that how, what the different kinds of traditions we are brought up with, or the different cultural practices that we are taught right from when we are children, or our different religious norms, all of these things actually play a very crucial role in shaping our aging processes. And aging is a subjective process. It is not really a homogeneous process.
All right, absolutely. You use Pierre Bourdieu's idea of capital to understand aging. I would like to know more about how you apply this concept, and what are some of these interesting insights that you discovered in your field?
Yes, I do use Bourdieu's concept of social capital, and I primarily used it in the context of when I was doing my fieldwork in Delhi. My Delhi chapter actually looks at Bourdieu's theory of social capital. So I'll just briefly talk about, how I used Bourdieu was, I explained that, you know, the different forms of capital, cultural, social, and economic. And as Bourdieu says, that social capital really helps particular members of a group to grow and connect with each other. So what I found was that in Delhi, there was this huge narrative of global aging. And the older people were very, very active on different social media websites. And so by using Bourdieu's capital, my most important finding was that because everybody in their age group was active on social media, hitting the gym and, you know, remaining active and fit and following different forms of dietary practices that was being used in across the globe, they just didn't want to come across as, you know, Indian older people, but they wanted to be seen as aging, and, you know, in their process of aging, that they are adopting global practices. So they, like, for example, most of them said that they follow Kim Kardashian and Victoria Beckham, and, you know, like, they were following international figures because they believed that those people were really the epitome of, like, they were aging gracefully, and they were the role models. So because of that, and because everybody in their group was doing that, and because social media played such a big role in shaping the entire process of aging, I have used Bourdieu's social capital to explain that how being a member of a particular group, who, you know, kind of induces a particular way of growing old. So that was my main contribution.
Okay. So could you also give some examples of how class, gender, and age intersect from your research in both India and Canada?
Yeah. So honestly, I didn't look at class. I didn't look at class because I looked at one particular type of class, and that was the middle class, the upper middle class. But I'll just broadly give you, you know, a narrative of like how generally class and age work. So one of the biggest differences is that in India, people, mostly the people I interviewed, some of them had pensions, but most of them also had personal savings. And personal savings was the main resource of, you know, financial resource that they had. And they kind of received little benefits from remittances from their adult children. That was not the main source of financial resources for them in later life. So class-wise, one of, I think, the reason a lot of people could choose to become independent in India was because they had financial stability. They weren't really dependent on their adult children, because legally, even today, the law really states that it is the responsibility of the adult children to look after older people, their older parents. And there is a lacuna in terms of, you know, like what about childless older people and those who have lost their children, all of that, that there is a gap. But my main point also was that because these older people have sufficient savings or they are pension holders, they are not really that dependent on their children. So they could choose to, like, for instance, I have highlighted this in my Kolkata chapter, that a lot of older people particularly chose to remain alone and not stay with their adult children. Instead, they choose to, you know, live with in their later life with memory and the loss of their partner. And they wanted to live just within the city of Kolkata. The city also played a very crucial role. They could afford to do that because they were financially independent. So I think class in that sense plays a very big role. Of course, I did not do a cross-class comparison, you know, across different class groups, even in the urban setting. I have to admit that. But I have to say that class did play a very significant role in this context, because this financial stability played in with age. In Canada, they have a huge state support. And that actually plays a very big role. Like the fact that they don't really have to depend on their spouses, or they don't have to depend on their adult children, or for that matter, they don't have to really depend on anybody, is because the state support is very, very huge. And because of that, and also the retirement age is also, you know, 5 years ahead. When I was doing my interviews, like 65 for Canada and 60 for India, that also made a lot of difference. And because of these, because of that state support there, well, my Canada citizens were more, you know, upper middle class as opposed to my citizens back in India. And their financial stability was very, very high. And that gave them a huge sense of independence. And that, I think, is very important as, you know, if I had done a class comparison. Gender, it was a huge marked difference. And, you know, like as I said earlier, that gender norms continue to exist in the Indian setting. And that is across, like, even though I explored global aging in Delhi, most of the older males told me that they want their older spouses, female spouses, to look after them as they grow older. And the female spouses primarily told me that they would have to rely on paid caregiving or elder care residences. They can't expect their male spouses to look after them because they're not even trained. So that kind of an expectation was missing. And this expectation that older female spouses will look after older male husbands was omnipresent across India, like all the field visits I had in India. That was a narrative that I had. In fact, in elder care residences, a lot of the older men had shifted to residences because their spouse had passed away and they had no other option. So that gender thing was very huge. Of course, in contrast to this, in Canada, the older women were very independent. All of them knew driving, and they took their own decisions. They actually chose to live alone. And they would definitely not provide later life care to their older spouses. Like, there was a sense of independence across gender. So these were some of the major, you know, differences that I saw with regard to class, gender, and age.
All right. So since you talk about state support and also paid care homes, I would want to know a little bit about, you know, the relationship between the two. Do you think that because state support was much higher in Canada than in India, there were fewer care homes there compared to India, or is it the opposite, or is there no relationship?
No, there is a huge relationship. I will say that because of huge state support, a lot of older people can choose to live in their own houses and pay for assisted living or, you know, paid caregiving services in the house. So that is definitely there in Canada, that, you know, one can choose to do whatever one wants to because of higher state support, which is much higher as compared to the financial support that older Indians had. I will not be able to tell you how many elder care residences are really there in Canada, because I also did not get any permission to do any interviews in any elder care residences. I didn't even visit. So I really do not have any knowledge about that. Like, whatever knowledge I have is basically based on the literature I've read. I did not have any personal experience. In comparison, of course, elder care residences are coming up in India. It's not that high in number. They are coming up because even today, even though they are coming up and they are, as you know, a lot of people view it as an alternative caregiving arrangement, but it is still seen as a very alien concept. And mostly older people prefer to live in their own houses. And, because it's kind of, there's a lot of stigma also associated with moving into an elder care residence. So because of that, even if, you know, there might be certain facilities, people would prefer not to shift. That is also there. But there is also one more thing, and that I have not really explored in my book, but is a very important concept, and that is hospices, you know, which is end-of-life care. So a lot of elder care who are receiving end-of-life care, primarily not just in Canada, but across the West, North America, they do move to, you know, private-funded hospices or the good hospice services, which are actually very underdeveloped. Like, palliative care is very underdeveloped in India. So in that sense, I think that state support matters and plays a very big role. It offers more choices to the older people as compared to the ones that who do not receive any form of state support.
Right, right. So I would also want to know that what would be some other sociological works on aging that you would recommend to our listeners?
Yes. So firstly, I would recommend Professor Sara Lamb's work. She is a faculty member at Brandeis University. I'm hugely influenced by her work, and she has written extensively on older care practices in India, primarily in Kolkata, where her field, you know, where she did her field work. The names of the book are White Saris and Sweet Mangoes. Then she also did a comparison between India and US, and that was also one of the inspirations behind my book. You know, I was very influenced by her work, and the name of the book is Aging and the Diaspora, Aging in India and the Diaspora, Cosmopolitan Practices in India and Abroad, that one. Her latest book, Successful Aging is a Contemporary Obsession, that is also a very important book, and it really critiques the North American medical model of successful aging, which is, you know, gradually being adopted across the globe. So that those are some of the books. Lawrence Cohen's No Aging in India, an excellent contribution to medical anthropology, social gerontology. Though I didn't really talk about elder abuse, but another very important topic, and Professor Mala Kapoor Shankar Das, who works, who looks at the intersections between policy, abuse, and aging, has really made very important contributions. And her latest book, I think, is Aging and Social Responses and Policies in India. But she's also coming up with a very good book on end-of-life care practices. And so these are some of the books I would recommend for the readers. Yeah. For listeners, thank you.
Thank you, Jagriti. Your research sounds fascinating, but as we know, every research is fraught with its own set of challenges. So I would also want to share some of the challenges that you faced in doing this research.
Yes. I'll just say that, you know, there were different challenges across different fields. So for example, when I started doing interviews, of older people who had just lost their spouse, I really had to wait a while and get permission first from the adult child, because it would be very hard to talk about, you know, loss and how, and so I really waited for like a year and a half. And I really got in touch much later when I realized that, you know, they would be in a position to talk. So I think waiting and time and patience are very important virtues one really needs to adopt while doing fieldwork. Similarly, I was rejected multiple times by multiple institutional settings to do any kind of data collection, you know, in elder care residences. And that was also a very big challenge. And I really had to, I ultimately went through an NGO, which, you know, got me permission. Otherwise, I was just not able to make any progress. Similarly, family setting, again, it was a major challenge because, you know, there were so many family members and they had so many questions. And getting each of them at different points in time, you know, their different work schedules, meeting them in different, many of them didn't want to do the interviews in homes and they wanted to meet me in public spaces. So reaching there, navigating those places, again, they were, you know, major challenges in themselves. And I did not speak the language, which I learned later, and that was really very helpful. And but yeah, so doing fieldwork in different contexts also comes with multiple language barriers, particularly in India, where, you know, people speak so many different languages. So those were all major challenges in India. Canada, I think it took me a while to get used to the country because I was jet lagged. I was, you know, I didn't know too many people. I didn't know how to go about. I didn't even know how to approach. So I'm very grateful to, you know, Professor David Parkinson, who introduced me to a lot of older Indians settled in Canada. And he really did a lot of hand-holding. So I think without a local contact was very helpful. I would not have been able to make any progress in doing my data collection in a, you know, in a foreign or in a transnational setting. So one thing I learned while doing my data collection is that how challenging the whole process is. And I also realized that my knowledge is very textbookish and one really has to be on the field to really learn the job, you know, and it is. And also, which is why I later reflected on those questions, that one has to be prepared to, you know, understand and examine how does one own background in terms of class, caste, age, gender, marital status, nationality, educational status. You know, they also play a very big role in influencing you as a researcher on the field. So I think I of course thought about them much later, but I think those were some of my learning experiences and some of my, you know, like eye-opening experiences for me.
Thank you for putting it so, you know, rawly out there. It's interesting to hear about challenges that go into making a research, what it is, and then a published book. Last question, Jagriti, what do you think is the scope of future research in this area?
Yeah. So, yes, thank you very much for this very important question. I think more comparative studies need to be done, you know, like India and other, like definitely bit, you know, like India, Japan and or India and Singapore, because India's aging population is actually growing and growing by leaps and bounds. And the caregiving arrangements in India are particularly changing people because of out-migration. Adult children are no longer the sole caregivers anymore. So either a lot of people are depending on their older spouses or, and with the death of those female spouses, then paid caregiving is becoming a huge factor, particularly in urban India or followed by elder care residences. So I think this kind of comparative work definitely needs to be done between, you know, different countries, because a lot of countries, particularly like, for example, Japan, Singapore, and even China, they have already identified that, you know, aging population is a potential problem and have come up with policies and are doing extensive research. But in India, it's still is, you know, India, because it's still seen as a very young country and a demographically youth oriented country, older people and their needs really need are neglected. So that I think needs to be highlighted in terms of policy also. And I also think there should be more research on end-of-life care practices. It's like a huge field and a huge problem in India. I know some faculty members are doing it in India, but it really needs to be expanded much more. And of course, comparative, you know, work on those fields will also really help expand the scope of the discipline.
Thank you. Thank you, Jagriti.
Thank you so much, Rituparna. Thank you so much for this interview. And I'm very grateful that you took out the time to do it. And it was a lovely opportunity. Thank you again.
Thank you, Jagriti. I hope our viewers enjoy listening to you and learn a lot about the sociological process and context in variations in aging.
Thank you.